Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Thank you so much, Candace, and I too would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect Education Workshop update on glioblastoma. This is a very important program and one that we have collaborated with a number of organizations in making this program possible, a number of cancer organizations, and I particularly want to note the brain tumor organizations. So we have the Brain Tumor Foundation and Brain Cancer Initiative, Chris Elliott Fund, and National Brain Tumor Society, in addition to all the other collaborating organizations, cancer organizations that we work with. And because of that collaboration and your interest in the topic today, we have over 357 participants on the call today. This is a very large group of people on the call today. And we also have international participants outside of the United States from Australia, Canada, Costa Rica, Greece, Sweden, Turkey, and the United Kingdom. So this is truly a global call. We have people from all over the world on this call, and it's a credit to each of you that you've chosen to spend this next hour with us. Now, today's program was supported by Bristol-Myers Squibb and Celldex Therapeutics, and I really want to thank them for their support of today's program. Now, we have wonderful speakers on our program today, and I want to begin by introducing our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Jeffrey Bruce, and Dr. Bruce is the Edgar M. Houspian Professor of Neurological Surgery, Vice Chairman, Department of Neurosurgery, Columbia University College of Physicians and Surgeons, Co-Director of Brain Tumor Center, Director of Bartoli Brain Tumor Research Collaboratory. And Dr. Bruce is going to actually address an overview of glioblastoma, including current standard of care, novel treatment approaches, the important role of clinical trials, how research contributes to treatment options, and communicating with your healthcare team about quality of life concerns. It's really my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Bruce.
Well, thank you, Carolyn. I'm delighted to be here on behalf of Cancer Care. You know, Cancer Care is a wonderful organization, and I've had the great pleasure of being associated with it for many years. This organization has been very helpful for many patients and their families, and they really provide a great service by educating and providing support for those of you who are out there suffering from brain tumors. This is an exciting time to be in the brain tumor field, as there are many new advances in the treatment and diagnosis in glioblastoma. In fact, there are more scientists working on brain tumors now than at any time in our history. Glioblastomas are what is known as primary brain tumors. That is, they begin in the brain and they grow from within. And this is distinct from metastatic brain tumors, which are tumors that have spread from somewhere else in the body into the brain. Now, glioblastomas are malignant or cancerous brain tumors, and they can spread to other parts of the brain or spinal cord, but they rarely spread to other parts of the body. And they really cause problems by being invasive tumors, so that most of the treatment that's out there is designed to control the tumor at the location in the brain where the tumor actually begins. And, you know, a lot of people wonder where brain tumors come from, and I can say that there are researchers out there who are trying to determine what causes brain tumors. But at this point, no one really truly knows. It's clear that nothing you did caused your brain tumor, and there was nothing you could have done to prevent it. Glioblastomas are diagnosed when somebody develops any of a number of symptoms, and this can include headaches, seizures, weakness, balance problems, or speech difficulties. And usually they're diagnosed when you get an MRI scan. Now, the current standard of care relies on surgery followed by 6 weeks of radiation and then chemotherapy with a drug called Temodar. And in the treatment of glioblastoma, the first step of it is surgery. And the goal of surgery is to try and remove as much of the tumor as possible. And depending on where the tumor is located, a surgeon may be able to remove most of it or nearly all of it. But if it's in a very difficult area of the brain or a very important area of the brain, then it may only be possible to remove a small portion of it. And in some cases, you can only do a biopsy. That is, just get a little piece of the tumor to make the diagnosis. So The problem with these tumors is that they invade into the normal brain. So you have tumor cells mixing in with normal brain cells, and that's why it's not possible to completely remove them, because if you completely remove them, you'd be removing a lot of normal brain cells as well, and that would lead to some unacceptable problems. There are a variety of techniques and tools that make surgery safer than ever. So most people that undergo surgery do really quite well. And surgery accomplishes two goals. One is to remove some of the mass effect or pressure on the brain that is causing the problem to begin with. And the other is to provide the tissue to give to the pathologist so the pathologist can look at it and actually make the diagnosis. Afterwards, many patients are on steroids after the surgery to try and reduce the amount of swelling in the brain. And many patients are on anticonvulsants, which are medications to prevent seizures. Not everybody needs these medications, but certainly people who are at risk for seizures will benefit from that. Once the surgery is complete and the patient has recovered, he or she will then undergo 30 treatments of radiation therapy. So these 30 treatments are given Monday through Friday for 6 weeks. And you come in and get your radiation treatment, may only take a few minutes, and then you go home and you do this for 30 treatments. It's generally painless, but there are some side effects, and these can include some hair loss, maybe tiredness, possible skin irritation, but usually these things are very well tolerated. Chemotherapy is then given along with the radiation. And the standard chemotherapy is a drug called temozolomide, which is also known as Temodar. And this drug has been shown to be effective at slowing down a tumor's growth. It's usually given during the radiation or sometimes after the radiation is complete. In any event, it is effective in whatever manner it's given. So when we talk about the standard of care for patients with glioblastoma, it includes surgery, radiation, and Temodar. And essentially all patients who have a diagnosis of glioblastoma will get those three treatments. Now, when a tumor grows back after a patient has had the standard treatment, then one of the many novel experimental treatments out there becomes an option. And there are fairly wide variety of novel treatment approaches. And as I said, there are more people working on brain tumors now than at any time in history. And the type of novel treatments that most people are familiar with are the different types of chemotherapy. Now, there are many new drugs that are being developed all the time, and they're mostly designed to target the growth of brain tumors, to keep the tumors from growing. And some of the novel treatment approaches include using ways to alter the chemotherapy so that it penetrates better into the brain, so that you get more of it into the tumor. And also, many of the drugs are designed to have less side effects while at the same time being more effective at killing tumor cells. One of the big areas of investigation involves all of the advances that the basic scientists are making in understanding the molecular biology of brain tumors. And that is understanding what actually makes a tumor grow, what makes it behave the way it does. And scientists have been able to determine very detailed molecular and genetic analysis of these individual tumors. That is, they can take these tumors and they can look at all the genetic material and all of the enzymes and proteins in the tumor and begin to understand what is causing the tumor to grow. And the ability to do this for individual tumors has led to a lot of excitement for what we are beginning to call personalized therapy. And what this means is that scientists can analyze a given tumor and determine what parts of the tumor are causing it to grow and what parts of the tumor are different from other people's tumors. So with that in mind, it's possible to choose special drugs that target the individual problems in a given tumor so that every person's tumor is different. And if you can analyze it, you can potentially pick the specific drugs that work best for that person. Now, this work is all very preliminary, and it's not been developed to the point where it can be mass-produced so that every individual can get that. But that's hopefully something that's coming in the very near future. Other types of drugs that are designed out are being designed are drugs that affect the growth of blood vessels in the brain, or so-called angiogenesis inhibitors, or drugs that block the invasion of the brain, that is, they keep the tumor cells from moving and invading into brain tissue. And I think finally there are a number of very promising drugs that Dr. Wong is going to discuss later in this hour that involves immunotherapy and drugs that boost the immune system. And these drugs are often given in combination with other immunotherapies such as vaccines. Finally, in the novel development area, there are some developments in everything from gene therapy and the use of viruses to attack certain parts of the tumor. And these are some very sophisticated treatments that have been being worked on in research laboratories now, and some of them are just getting into clinical trials right now. But those are some of the future areas that are being investigated. So overall, there's a lot of hope out there because there's the ability to develop these entirely different approaches to treatment. So a lot of optimism out there for finding new treatments. As I've mentioned several times, there's never been a better time out there for brain tumor research. There are many exciting new trials that are being carried out, and because they're experimental, it's not really clear which of these are going to end up being the best treatment. That is something that can only be determined by these clinical trials. And so those of you who have a glioblastoma and have already had standard treatment realize that once you've had the standard treatment, there's no real proven treatment beyond that. And the hope is that these clinical trials will discover the best new treatments possible. Therefore, I would strongly urge all of you out there to be involved in clinical trials if at all possible, not only for the obvious reason that you might find a new treatment that will dramatically improve your condition, but also because it will help other people that may develop brain tumors in the future. An added benefit is that clinical trials are generally run by some of the best people in neuro-oncology. And this means that when you have when you're involved in a clinical trial, you'll be taken care of by some of the most dedicated and hardworking physicians in the brain tumor field. And having them as part of your team will provide the highest level of care, really regardless of whether or not you're actually involved in the experimental protocol. You'll just have good doctors taking care of you, if nothing else. I wanted to conclude this segment about talking to you about communicating with your healthcare team. It goes without saying that you should seek out the most reputable, best specialists in brain tumor treatments as possible. And you can find these individuals easily over the internet. The internet has made things much easier to try and locate the best people. You can also get it by having a discussion with your primary care doctor or talking to friends and family who may have some experience with this. And of course, groups like Cancer Care can steer you in the right direction as well. Now, when you're diagnosed with a brain tumor, you start to hear all kinds of stories and anecdotes about friends and relatives who had tumors and had this happen to them or that happened to them. And sometimes it can be success stories, but sometimes they can be really scary things that may have happened. And I think you should be careful and skeptical about these anecdotes, as they may not really apply in the same way to your specific condition. I think everybody's tumor is different, and everybody's treatment is different as well. And if there's any question about that, you can get a second opinion. Second opinions are useful. If you have some doubts about your current doctor, then it's reasonable to go ahead and get a second opinion. And that second opinion can maybe reinforce what you already know and maybe provide some reinforcement that you're actually doing the right thing. Now, it's important to have some control over your lifestyle, given all the inconveniences of seeing doctors and getting tests and treatments. It can really be very disruptive to your lifestyle, goes without saying. So keeping a notebook or using your smartphone to jot down notes and reminders will help to make sure that you're not overwhelmed by dealing with your condition. And along those lines, it's important to work with your healthcare team and your friends and family so that you maintain the highest quality of life possible. And this is very doable. Just because you have a brain tumor, no one is saying that you can't visit a mall or enjoy your birthday party or have a nice meal or see a good movie. It's important to continue to live your life to the highest degree possible despite any diagnosis or side effects that you may be suffering. This is by far the best way to cope with your tumor. So I'm going to stop here, and I'll turn the program over to our next speaker. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Bruce. That was really outstanding and really lots of information, but also that emphasis on quality of life. And I know there'll be questions about that during the Q&A, but that's so important. Thank you so much. And our next speaker is Dr. Eric Wong, and Dr. Wong is Associate Professor, Harvard Medical School, Director of the Neuro-Oncology Unit, Co-Director, Brain Tumor Center, Department of Neurology, Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. Dr. Wong is going to address immunotherapy, electric field treatments, managing symptoms and treatment side effects, and the role of rehabilitation medicine. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Wong.
Well, thank you very much, Carolyn. And Dr. Bruce has done a very good job in terms of laying the foundation of this disease called glioblastoma and some of the approaches in terms of patient care and patient management. And it is critical that we have this foundation before we go into the specifics. So I'm going to talk about a number of specific management issues. The first one that I'm going to talk about is immunotherapy. And basically, immunotherapy is divided into two types, passive versus active immunotherapy. So think of passive immunotherapy as taking off the brakes on your car so that your car can go farther, faster, and accelerate. So there are these drugs that are FDA approved that are used in other malignancies. So for example, a drug named ipilimumab was approved for use in metastatic melanoma. There are other drugs called pembrolizumab and nivolumab that have all been approved in the past 2 to 3 years, and they are primarily approved for use in metastatic melanomas and metastatic lung cancer. There are many drugs that are currently in clinical trials from various types of companies that are designing safer and better drugs. And this class of drugs is called checkpoint inhibitors. Okay, they are basically allows the immune systems to work faster and better in terms of eliminating the tumors. So other than checkpoint inhibitors, there's another categories of drugs that also act like ticking off the brakes on the immune system, and these are small molecule tyrosine kinase inhibitors that kind of deactivates some of the immunosuppressive immune cells that are going inside the tumors to kind of turn off the immune system attacks. So, and there are a number of them that are currently in clinical trial, and some of them are promising. Now, as far as active immunotherapies, think of these treatments as stepping on the accelerators. And there are two types. One type are basically cell-based. A neurosurgeon like Dr. Bruce would remove the tumor, and then the tumor would be homogenized, and the antigens are extracted, and then we have to take the what we call the dendritic cells, and these are the antigen-presenting cells from the patient, and then we put the antigen and the antigen-presenting cells together in a petri dish in the laboratory to sensitize these antigen-presenting cells, and then we inject it into the patient. And then these cells would automatically do a seek and destroy mission to eliminate the tumor. There are a number of this type of personalized type of vaccines against the tumor. There's also another type in which patients are in which these vaccines are pre-exposed to a pre-selected number of antigens, either one or either five or a number of them. So these antigens include things like epidermal growth factor receptor, epidermal growth factor receptor V3, IL-13, GP100. So there are a number of antigens that we can potentially use that we can sensitize the immune-presenting cells to activate this type of active immunotherapy. Now, no matter what type of immunotherapy that that you are going to get in clinical trials, one of the important things is that you have to get whatever drug treatments and whatever immunosuppression that you have on your tumor to a minimum. Okay, the first point that I would like to make is that in a lot of these protocols, they require patients to have maximum surgical resection. So going to an experienced neurosurgeon like Dr. Bruce or other very experienced brain tumor neurosurgeons is key to help you to take out the tumor as much as you can, because on one hand, you will have more tumor cells to allow the experimental protocols to make a vaccine for you. The second reason is that the more tumor that comes out, the fewer tumor cells that are left behind to do the immune suppression of the patient's own immune system. The second point that I would like to make is that quite often our patients are on an immunosuppressive drug called dexamethasone. And another important reason for removing the tumor as much as possible is to decrease dexamethasone requirement. If a patient cannot wean off the dexamethasone, that's okay. If we can try other drugs that can bring down the dosage of dexamethasone, that would certainly help. So drugs such as Celebrex, there's an antihypertensive drug that can also decrease edema in the brain. It is the class that's called ARB that has some small efficacy in terms of decreasing the edema in the brain. Taking a COX-2 inhibitor like Celebrex can shift the patient's immune system towards a immunostimulatory way against the glioblastoma. So there are a number of there are definitely a number of immunotherapy protocols that are available all over the countries at the major medical centers, as well as something that patients can do to help themselves to make the immunotherapy work better. The second type of treatment that I would like to spend some time on is called the electric field therapy, or the alternating electric field therapy. And this is a new treatment that was initially approved by the Food and Drug Administration back in 2011. For recurrent glioblastoma, and more recently, in November 2015, it was approved for use in newly diagnosed glioblastoma. And patients have to shave their head and put on these arrays on their scalp, and they have to wear a an electric field generator or plug into a wall while they are asleep. And these alternating electric fields, the purpose of it is to disrupt the tumor cells as they undergo mitosis. Mitosis is a process in which one tumor cell turns into two. And during this period of time, the chromosome splits into two daughter cells, and then the cell body also splits into two, and the alternating electric fields would disrupt this process. The cells is stressed, and then the cells eventually disintegrate. In the phase three trial for recurrent glioblastoma, the alternating electric field therapy has been shown to have roughly equivalent efficacy compared to conventional chemotherapies, but without the side effects. In the just completed phase three clinical trial for newly diagnosed glioblastoma, the alternating electric fields was combined with temozolomide chemotherapy, and it has a superior overall survival as well as a progression-free survival advantage when compared to those patients who just took temozolomide alone. Now, our team here in Boston has been looking at this type of therapy very closely, and there are a number of points that I would like to make. In order to maximize the benefit of alternating electric field therapies or tumor-treating fields therapy, patients have to wear the device more than 75% of the time or more than 18 hours per day. And sometimes the treatment may take as long as 6 months to produce a response, if there's a response. Because think of it this way, this is similar to radiation, but the intensity of the radiation is lower, so and this is like a slow-burning type of radiation. And another thing that we uncover is that the tumor treating fields also sensitizes the immune system, so it is therefore important to use the minimum amount of dexamethasone necessary, 4 milligrams or less, to control symptoms. If that's not possible, combine it with bevacizumab or wean dexamethasone or add Celebrex. Now, I would like to spend some time to talk about managing symptoms and treatment side effects. And this is an important issue because on one hand, we want to offer the best treatment, either conventional or experimental, to our patients. But on the other hand, symptom management is an important piece of care for glioblastoma patients. So there are a number of things. So the first thing is infections. Because patients sometimes are on high doses of dexamethasone, opportunistic infections may appear. So it is very important for patients who are on steroids and temozolomide to take Bactrim to prevent a very common type of opportunistic infection called pneumocystis pneumonia. Clots can happen, so patients need to be active. And, you know, sometimes patients feel weak. They just don't want to be active, and a family members who can act as a coach or a personal trainer can help motivate them to be a little bit more active by either taking walks on a warm day or going to the mall, taking walks there in the mall when the weather is cold outside. Patients may encounter attentional deficits, and they may be manifesting as slowing in thinking or forgetfulness. And the clinical trial has been done. There's a drug called methylphenidate or Ritalin can actually activate the brain and help patients to do their daily activities better and retain their memory better. Sometimes patients' family may need to think of custodial help because having a social support network is very important for patients with this disease because there are times that they are dependent on other members of the family in order to take them to doctor's appointments or to take them to various places. And it is important to think ahead and try to gather the social help that is necessary to help them with their activities of daily living. There are the last point that I would make in this category is some of the financial issues because Medicare insurance companies' policies may change with time. Therefore, it is very important to know the important social workers in your care team so that they can help you to navigate the insurance system and also dealing with co-pays and stuff like that. And always think ahead and watch for added costs to the patients. The last topic that I would like to talk about is the role of rehabilitation medicine. And this is very important because the brain is a plastic organ, plastic meaning that the brain can adapt to the new equilibrium. So for a patient who had surgery, who had radiation, who had chemotherapy, what kind of things can the patient do in order to maximize their functional capability? So the first thing that they can do is exercise, because exercise can increase blood flow to the brain. Exercise can prevent blood clots. Exercise can just in general promote good health. The second thing that patients can do is do these brain games like crossword puzzles, Sudoku, play Monopoly with a family members, or if you have the means to subscribe to Luminosity, to do these brain games in order to keep your mind busy and activated. And at my hospital, we have what we call a Brain Fit Club program in which we test for patients for subtle balance problems and neurocognitive deficits and then correct them early on. The final point that I would like to make is that patients with glioblastoma is going through a difficult period. However, there are a lot of organizations like Cancer Care, like Chris Elliott Fund, who can help patients to navigate through this unfamiliar territory. And having a trusted team, a trusted expert team, in your city or in your closest city to take care of you with various specialists like expert neurosurgeon like Dr. Bruce, neuro-oncologist, radiation oncologist, social workers, case managers, neuro-oncology nurses, research nurses. Get to know every one of them. And they will help guide you to good health. So I will stop here, and I'll give the podium to the next speaker. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Dr. Wong. That was really excellent and very comprehensive and informative, and also the concept of working with that whole team, having everybody on board and helping. So it's really very important messages here. Thank you. And our next speaker is Mr. Andrew Chesler. Mr. Chesler is an oncology social worker here at Cancer Care, and he'll be addressing Cancer Care's free psychosocial programs and services and the role of support groups. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Mr. Chesler.
Thank you, Carolyn. It's a pleasure to be part of this call today. I'd like to start by emphasizing the importance of creating a support network when you're diagnosed with glioblastoma and how Cancer Care can be a part of that network. There are many ways we can help. So Cancer Care is a national nonprofit organization that provides free professional support services to anyone affected by cancer. Cancer Care programs include individual counseling, support groups, education about resources, and how to navigate the healthcare system, practical help, and some limited financial assistance which includes some copayment assistance for patients diagnosed with glioblastoma. All of our services are delivered by master's level oncology social workers, and all our services are completely free of charge. Oncology social workers are trained in how a diagnosis of cancer affects a person and his or her family and friends. And we are experienced in helping people to manage the emotional, physical, and the financial challenges that arise from a diagnosis. Adjusting to and dealing with the diagnosis is an important part of the healing process. I'd like to also emphasize that asking for help by joining a support group or by contacting a social worker for counseling is a sign of strength. Cancer Care offers face-to-face groups in our local offices in the New York area, but also telephone and online groups, and those groups are available nationally. These groups offer a unique opportunity to connect with other people impacted by glioblastoma, along with the help of a cancer care social worker who facilitates the group. Sharing information and understanding with others in similar situations can be a very powerful experience. Group members offer encouragement and a sense of community that can provide you with additional support and guidance. These connections help lessen the isolation that many people with cancer experience. As we've learned from today's program, there's a lot of information to digest and to make sense of. Our social workers can help you understand what all this means for you and your family. A cancer care social worker can help you prioritize and consider the questions that you might want to ask to get the answers and the information that you need. Please remember that you're not alone. Cancer care services are here to help you. So please contact us at 1-800-813-HOPE or log on to our website at www.cancercare.org for more information about our oncology social work support. Thank you for your attention and the opportunity to talk with you today.
Oh, thank you so much, Mr. Chesel. That was excellent and really wonderful review of our services, and these are free and do take advantage of them. And of course, there are other organizations too, but we do have some unique services. And I do actually want to also mention that we do have a copay assistance program here at Cancer Care, and we do have funds for glioblastoma. So just for anyone who's struggling with the cost of your care, that's another wonderful resource as well. And simply call Cancer Care and our staff will assist you with that. And now we have time for questions. We actually have a lot of time for questions. I'm going to ask Candace if she would bring all of our speakers on board and if she would also explain to the audience how to queue up for questions. I'm going to try to take as many of your questions as possible. And I know we have a lot of online questions always coming in. And we will. And if we don't get your questions, I will give you information about how to get your questions answered at the end of the call. So we won't leave you without your questions being answered as well. Okay, so Candace?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star and then the number one key on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Those of you on the web may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question. Again, to ask a question at this time, please press star 1.
And we have a question from one of our online participants, actually. And the question is, are there any risk factors associated with developing glioblastoma? And Dr. Bruce, if you could address that question.
Well, you know, there are no good studies on risk factors. There may be some people who have had radiation treatment for whatever reason, or people who have been around certain chemical manufacturing and vinyl in particular, but those links are really kind of weak. Nobody really knows what causes them. There are some very, very rare cases of genetic tumors where that run in families, but those are extremely rare. And so suffice it to say, nobody really knows what causes them. And you know, as an aside, everybody always asks about cell phones, and as far as we can tell, there's no really credible evidence to show that cell phones cause brain tumors.
Excellent, thank you. And a question, actually, this will be for Dr. Wong. This is a question from Jennifer. What can I do to help with my insomnia as a result of Decadron?
Can you address that? Yeah, this is a great question. This question actually comes up quite often among my patients. So one thing that patients can do is to take the last dose of the Decadron as early in the afternoon as possible. So this may not be apparent to a lot of patients or a practitioner. It doesn't really matter how you split the dexamethasone. You can take it all in one day. You can split it into two doses, or you can split it into 10 doses. The anti-swelling effect on the brain works the same. The reason why we split them is because when patients are taking more than 4 milligrams a day, it may upset their stomach, making them more prone to have ulcers. So, so for example, if patients are taking 4 milligrams a day, they can combine it and take it all in the morning, and then they would be done for the day. If they are taking, say, 8 milligrams a day, they can split it into two doses, and the first dose early in the morning, the second dose at noon. Then they won't come into the problem of taking a dose of dexamethasone too close to bedtime. So if patients are taking four doses, they can take it all, four doses before, say, 4 p.m. of the day, and that would minimize the insomnia side effects from dexamethasone. If necessary, patients may take a gabapentin to help them to sleep. Patients may take trazodone to help them to sleep, or other adjunctive medications to help them to sleep.
Excellent. Thank you so much. That's really helpful. And then a question actually for Dr. Bruce. Is there an appropriate time for tumor resection and aggressive treatment for patients with low-grade glioma? This is from Jonathan.
Yes, actually, there's more and more evidence supporting the notion of trying to remove low-grade gliomas aggressively. So low-grade gliomas tend to grow relatively slowly, and sometimes they may cause a seizure or cause some other minor problems. But the big problem that occurs with low-grade gliomas is that they eventually become high-grade gliomas. And when they switch from being a low-grade to a high-grade, that's when they grow quickly, and that's when they invade the brain and cause a lot of problems. So among neuro-oncologists, there's a better appreciation that if you can safely remove a low-grade glioma while it's still a low-grade glioma, then you either reduce the chance or at least delay the possibility of that tumor growing back as a high-grade glioma. And so the sort of standard thinking these days is, if possible, low-grade gliomas should be removed. Now, there are caveats to that. Not every low-grade glioma needs to be removed, and some low-grade gliomas are in more dangerous areas. But as a principle, when possible, low-grade gliomas should be removed as aggressively as possible.
Excellent. Thank you so much. And these are excellent questions, I must say. It's a great audience and participants. And I know there are many more questions. And I have a question for Dr. Wong. This question is from Ellen. I have a rash resulting from Dilantin. Are there any topical creams that you would recommend to treat this?
Sure. The most important thing when patients develop a rash from an anticonvulsant is to stop the anticonvulsant. And if they must take an anticonvulsant to manage their seizures, they should switch to another anticonvulsant. So when patients develop a rash from Dilantin, the drug that we would typically switch to would be Keppra or levetiracetam. And the rash can be very uncomfortable with itching and burning, and patients can certainly take some steroid, oral steroid for that. Unless the rash is really in a very small region of the skin, one can use topical steroid, but if it involves the entire chest area in the front and also the back area, then patients really need an oral steroid in order to suppress the rash. Two things, switching to another anticonvulsant if they have to be on anticonvulsants, or discontinue the anticonvulsants and use oral steroid most of the time. So that would be my recommendations.
Excellent. Thank you so much. These are really important questions, and I know people struggle with them. So the other question, and this is for Dr. Bruce, from Gwendolyn, do all glioblastoma patients experience seizures?
No, by no means. And many patients who have, if they've never had a seizure, many times they don't need to be on seizure medication. So not everybody gets a seizure.
Okay. And then there's another question from Jane. Are brain tumors hereditary? Dr. Wong, could you address that?
For the most part, the answer is no. Although there are some rare brain tumor syndromes, like Lee-Fumini syndrome, in which there are some germline genetic defect within generations of the family, but they are very, very rare. For the most part, most glioblastoma or most malignant gliomas or even low-grade gliomas are sporadic. They are not usually run in families.
Excellent. And we have another question from David for Dr. Bruce. Are all tumors genetically analyzed? And if you could say a bit more about that whole concept of genetic analysis.
Well, no, they're not all genetically analyzed. I think that there are certain places around the country where they're starting to do that. We just started a program here where we are going to do a genetic analysis on all brain tumor patients as they come in, and hopefully use that as a way to treat patients. But you'll find that more and more brain tumor centers around the country are doing at least some kind of genetic analysis. They may do a very comprehensive genetic analysis, which can be very expensive, or they may just look at specific genetic elements such as EGFR or IDH or P53, which are specific molecular genetic parts of the tumor that are found to be important in patients who have brain tumors. So it's, again, an exciting area of development for the future. It used to be extremely expensive. It's getting less expensive, and hopefully we'll see the day where all patients' tumors will be genetically analyzed and hopefully be used to find new and better treatments.
Excellent. Thank you. And with a question, actually, again, from our online participants, Chris, is it true that most therapy regimens for pediatric glioblastoma have cut out irinotecan from treatment plans that include Temodor and Avastin? Dr. Bruce, could you address that?
I'm sorry, can you repeat the question? The question
yes.
is about pediatric glioblastoma.
Yes, it is. Is it true that most therapy regimens for pediatric glioblastomas have cut out irinotecan from treatment plans that include Temodor and Avastin?
Well, I believe that Temodar is still used even for pediatric glioblastoma. Now, you know, there are a lot of different types of gliomas in children. You know, they're more prone to getting things like brainstem gliomas, and there the treatments are not as well not as well agreed upon on what the best treatment is. But for children, you know, it's my understanding that Temodar is still a first-line treatment. Maybe Dr. Wong has some different ideas on that.
I think traditionally the chemotherapy regimen for childhood glioma is carboplatin and vincristine. A little bit different from adults. But Temodar is also in use, and I believe, if my memory is correct, that there was cooperative group studies on this. Now, one thing is very important about pediatric brain tumors is that because pediatric brain tumors, they are not that common. Patients are usually treated in protocols across the country. So I think if the person who posed the question has a question about pediatric brain tumors, they may want to get a second opinion or even a third opinion from a large pediatric neuro-oncology program so that they can find out what protocols there are. There is a national pediatric oncology group called Children's Oncology Group or Pediatric Oncology Group in which the protocols are generated there and they are run at multiple centers across the country.
So that they might want to look into the Children's Oncology Group or Pediatric Oncology Group, and that would be they could find that information online or?
Yes, correct. I think they can go online to look at that organization, yes.
Okay. And we will actually try also to give you some resources on that as well. That's excellent, thank you. And we have another question from Gerard. We're trying to navigate healthcare costs and treatment costs. Local hospital social worker has made some suggestions, but we're wondering what we should do. Should we contact cancer care directly? Andrew, if you could address this in terms of just our cancer care assistance and then, of course, copay assistance as well.
Sure. Yes, I would suggest that the person who suggested submitted that question or anyone call us, and we will always speak to a social worker. We do have some copayment assistance for patients diagnosed with glioblastoma at this time, and we have a copay foundation. Again, you could contact us at our 800 number, which we will provide for you again, I know, and speak with a social worker, and we will put you in touch with our copay department. We also have some funds. They're limited, but funds for transportation as well. And, again, talking with our social workers here, we will put you in touch with other organizations as well as we can to help with that.
Thank you. And a question from Patricia. My husband is participating in a clinical trial of a checkpoint inhibitor, PD-L1. Can you comment on this? So I'll ask Dr. Bruce and Dr. Wong if you would comment on this. Good question.
Dr. Wong, go ahead. I think that's up your alley.
Okay, thank you. There are a number of checkpoint inhibitors. There is the anti-CTLA-4 monoclonal antibody, and the prototypic drug for that particular checkpoint inhibition is called ipilimumab. There's the anti-PD-1 monoclonal antibody, and there are two checkpoint inhibitors. They're called pembrolizumab and nivolumab. And anti-PD-L1 is a third category of checkpoint inhibitor. There's no drug approved by the FDA in this category yet. There's a drug called it only has a number, it doesn't have a name. It's called MPDL32808. It's from Genentech. That was in phase one clinical trial. It may go into phase two. If the listener would like to find out more about it, they can go to clinicaltrial.gov and find more information about which center would offer this particular type of checkpoint inhibitor. Basically, anti-PD-1 and anti-PD-L1 checkpoint inhibitors, they have fewer side effects than anti-CTLA-4 checkpoint inhibitor. So from a side effect standpoint, they are much better tolerated. And I believe that they work pretty much the same. there's some evidence, not in glioblastoma, but in melanoma, that combining two checkpoint inhibitor may work better than one. The most common combination is ipilimumab plus nivolumab, or ipilimumab plus pembrolizumab. Some of this combination is still in clinical trial. I think there are checkpoint inhibitors that are in Dr. Bruce's institution. Dr. Bruce, would you want to make some comment on this?
Yeah, no, I think as Dr. Wong discussed here, these are sort of very promising drugs because they help reverse some of the problems that we have with the immune system. And so we're using them in a number of patients. We've treated a lot of patients with it. The best I can tell you so far is that it's very well tolerated. There seem to be very few side effects. It's going to take us a little while to let you know how well they're working. So we're hopeful, but the good news is that they are now available. They seem to have low number of side effects, and we'll wait and see how effective they are.
Wow, this is so. In terms of clinicaltrial.gov, do you want to say a little bit more about that, Dr. Wong, in terms of that, what that stands for and what that represents in terms of that's a really go-to place for information about clinical trials?
Yes, clinicaltrial.gov is a government website in which every single clinical trial that is being conducted in the United States or involves patients in the United States has to be registered over there. Most of the glioblastoma trials are listed there, and it's a great resource for patients to look up what is available across the country. And it's a very easy to use. And in fact, in that website, when you click on the individual trial, it would list what are the inclusion criteria, what are the exclusion criteria, so the patients can get some sense of whether or not it's worthwhile to seek out to pursue the trial. But obviously, check with your neurosurgeon, check with your neuro-oncologist, and get their opinion as well.
Well, I want to thank our speakers. This has been really an extraordinary call. I want to thank our speakers for being wonderful. I want to thank all of you who have been listening and all of you who have asked such really wonderful questions that really allowed our speakers to expand on really important topics for you all to have information about. And I want to thank all of you who have been listening as well. I want to remind you that this is a one-hour program and that in planning a program like this, we do recognize that you have many needs that go far beyond the scope of 1 hour. So what I do suggest that if you have remaining questions, and I know some of you do still have questions, I do suggest you call the National Cancer Institute for your questions at 1-800-422-6237. It's a wonderful resource for questions that you might have. They have information specialists always lined up after our calls to answer your medically focused questions. So 1-800-422-6237. They have information about any of the questions you might have, about clinical trials, and they also can link you to their clinical trial specialists as well. In addition, if you have questions about getting assistance with copay assistance or with financial assistance or counseling services or wanting to join one of our support groups, a telephone or online support group, or just talk with one of our social workers, I would say to go ahead and call Cancer Care at 1-800-813-4673. And I do want to also call out to all of you that we are going to be doing another program on glioblastoma at the end of June, so please stay tuned, and we will send you information about that one as well, because there is so much going on in this area. We wanted to actually be sure to offer another program as well. And we also are doing a program on generally the concept of clinical trials for those of you who would like to learn more about clinical trials, and that's going to take place on May 20th. And so you'll all get information about that as well, and some of you have signed up already for that. Most importantly, however, as we conclude, I don't want anyone to think that you're alone in coping with glioblastoma or cancer. in general. I want you to know that you're now part of this cancer care world here and that we are here to help you. I mean, it's simply a phone call away, or for those of you internationally who want to come to our website, or anyone who wants to visit our website, please do, because you can access people that way, help as well. So remember that as often as you might feel that there is no one there for you, please do know that we are here for you, and we really do try to help and come up with solutions to the problems that you may be facing. So again, I want to thank you all and wish you all a very fine day.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes today's workshop, and you may all disconnect. Have a great day, everyone.